You know what I'm talking about when you think of a rocking chair?
I do.
It's got like these big arms and a high back. But it rocks, and that's good enough for me sometimes.
I mean, that would be nice. I'm very happy to have my spinny office chair. It affords me the opportunity to spin, which fills at least some of the same urge.
How fast can you spin?
Well, I'm kind of blocked by table and sofa, and I'm wearing headphones, but let's see.
Oh God.
Gonna have a lot of fun. Gonna hit a home run. In the littlest league possible. In the littlest league possible.
Hello and welcome once again to Tater Tots Book Boys Edition. I'm Tim.
And I'm Duncan.
And later on, we'll be talking about The Resistors by Gish Jen.
True.
That is... If you keep listening to this podcast and we don't wind up talking about The Resistors at all, you'll know that we've lied to you.
Right, and you can blame me for saying true.
Yeah, because that's where the lie emanated from, your affirmation of my... But it's not a lie. All of this is a moot point. It's not a lie. This is what we'll be talking about later. But first...
True.
First, there's the matter of my vertical and how many inches I've added to it. So let's play that music. If nothing else, it was a good week for jumping.
And I would say... Nothing else.
Gotten into a pretty good exercise habit. Cardio every day, weights every other day. My jumping has never been better. This week to 102.5 inches.
That's a remarkable improvement.
Yeah, I mean it's
an inch and 3/8.
Yeah, there you go. Over last
week. If you improved by an inch and 3/8 every week, you would easily fulfill your goal of dunking a basketball by February 15th.
I can only hope that would be the goal. I mean, that's not the right sentence.
It is the goal.
It is the goal. I can only hope that will be the case. Although I remain, let's say, realistic.
I hate that.
Oh, you want me to be just like, I will dunk a basketball tomorrow or something?
Yeah, kind of. I want you to really believe in yourself.
I do believe in myself, which is important, and it's not something that I necessarily felt when this exercise began. And, you know, I do think that part of the reason that we're seeing, especially over the last few weeks, such marked improvement has to do with my believing in myself. But I do not think I can believe myself to 120 inches by tomorrow.
No, that you're right. That would be unreasonable. But... I do think, you know, you got to set a lot of goals for yourself, keep motivated, but I love to see this progress, and it sounds like you're in a good place physically.
Starting to get into a little bit of a rhythm.
Yeah.
Miss the gym. Still miss the gym.
Me too.
Yeah. But what are you going to do? I think there's still a disease going on.
So I've heard... I gotta tell you, though, I miss lifting a heavy weight a couple times, as opposed to lifting very light weights or even no weights many, many times.
I can't say that I miss lifting no weights many times. I can't say it because I don't know what it means.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair.
What kind of weight are you moving these days?
I'm doing all calisthenics.
Oh, okay.
I've been on a 30-day calisthenics program.
Fun.
Which I've never really done before, but I have found it very... I mean, it's forced me to do a lot of cardio, which I usually don't do, and to exercise literally every day, no rest days. And I've been working my abs a lot more than usual, and I've noticed a little bit of ab development, and I'm happy with that.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Can you rank your top 5 calisthenics?
My top 5 calisthenic exercises?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I mean, I can tell you my least favorites.
Okay, start there.
My least favorite calisthenic exercise is mountain climbers.
Yeah, for sure.
Which I despise doing. Not literally one-arm push-ups, but push-ups where you load up on one side and push.
Oh.
I find those very difficult.
Huh. I've never heard of that.
Leaping lunges. That is an activity where you do a lunge and you hop and then you land directly into your next lunge and you do that for a long time. I find that incredibly difficult.
Switching legs every time?
Yes, yes.
Cross country is what we used to call them.
Oh, sure. That sounds like a good term for it.
Yeah. Not fun. Sneaky and seemingly much easier than jumpies, but you get tired.
Absolutely. Some of the calisthenics that I enjoy doing, bodyweight squats.
Good.
I find those pretty good.
Yeah.
My
favorite thing about squats, I'm sorry to say, to just jump in here,
absolutely, go ahead. This was very boring.
Especially bodyweight squats, is that you can really focus on your form, I feel like, because you don't have... you can just kind of like arrange your body in the proper manner and then do it.
I find it personally. I find that I'm able to focus on my body weight squat form.
Yeah.
But I do find that if I really wanted to focus on squat form, it's helpful to have a very light barbell.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense too.
In the past.
For me, it's a mental thing when I'm like trying to lift something as well as have good form while I'm lifting it, because I think I get in my head that like the goal is to lift this thing, and so I'm gonna do it by hook or by crook,
right,
whether or not that means using proper form. The thing that I like about body weight squats is that I can just focus on what my body is doing.
Tend to get sloppy with body weight squats, to be honest. I was really thinking today about keeping my back extended.
Mm-hmm.
Usually get sloppy with that.
Are you deliberate with your squats, or do you just kind of try to blast through them?
I do as many as my friend Bully Juice does. He's the man on the TV.
That's his name?
I assume that's his given name.
Hello. Please, Mr. Juice is my father. Call me Bully. Any other calisthenic highlights?
I've done so many jumping jacks. Oh. My neighbors haven't complained.
That's good.
So thank you to my neighbors for never complaining about my hundreds of jumping jacks every day, nor our subwoofer.
I gotta get a subwoofer.
Ours came with our soundbar. But you could probably get a superior one.
Well, with money. I bought some speakers with this new record player that wound up being more trouble than they were worth, because it was a 6-speaker surround sound thing.
Woo!
But yeah, it was just like a lot of wires, and I we don't really have the space to disguise things, I think, the way that you're supposed to with those.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up kind of mothballing the 6-speaker surround sound, but trying to salvage the subwoofer from that set, and I don't think that's how you're supposed to do it. I don't know anything about it, and I don't expect you to solve this problem in this moment. I just want
you think because it's like a different brand of speaker, it's not fitting with the rest of your acoustic environment.
No. I literally think that like it is not powering on because it's not like wired properly, like routed in with the TV and the other speakers, and I don't know if I need to connect the speakers to the... I don't know. It's very confusing. I'm not a... I wish I was more of a speaker person. I'm just not. There are too many inputs.
Yeah. I hope that you can get that sorted.
Me too. I would really like it. The speakers that I have are pretty good for bass, but it could be better.
You want that deep booming bass.
You know I want that deep booming bass.
You
want
to feel that music right in your chest and your soul.
Boom, ba-doom, boom. Boom, ba-doom, boom. The super bass, if you will.
Boom, 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 bass.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
I'm familiar.
Yeah. All right. That's our exercise and speaker equipment segment. add some inches to your
profile. Rapidly becoming our worst segment.
Well, it's just like there aren't that many updates nowadays because it's just more of the same. We might need to find a way to freshen it up or replace it with a different segment.
As we're wont to do.
As we are wont to do. I mean, it's literally, who's going to stop us? Let's jump into arguably our best segment, the Tot Stove.
I mean, I think, oh, okay.
Thank you.
Oh, fire. I think we obviously have a best segment.
Yeah, is it Snake Fact?
It's obviously Snake Facts, which delivers high-quality Snake Facts every episode.
It's definitely
with nair a discussion of body weight squats.
Snake Fact is definitely the most consistent segment, but I just feel like Tot Stove is really at the core of what we're doing.
That's true. I mean, it's thematically on point in a way that Snake Facts is less so.
Yeah, so it's a coin flip. I think maybe we put out a poll after this episode just seeing if people kind of come down on Team Tot Stove or Team Snake Fact.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get a sense of what the people want.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Some news in the Tot Stove this week from the KBO. Your friend and mine, Taylor Motter, was unfortunately released by the Kiwoom Heroes. This is something that we covered a little bit last week in our Tots of the KBO episode. It would have seemed that Taylor Motter was just not really adjusting to Korea. Although, I don't know, I think from what you've been sending me, it seems like he has become something of a persona non grata in Korea, but I think he was kind of dealt a bad hand. Not a bad hand, but like, it's bad timing for him, mostly, is how I feel.
It's tough to know what to make of it. So for one, he performed very poorly in his limited time in the KBO, such that I've received conflicting reports. When we talked about it last week, they said, oh, he's time to spend more time with his pregnant wife. I also heard that he played in the minors, and I literally don't know what's true because it is so much different to pay attention to Korean baseball than American baseball. But either way, yes, he was released by the Heroes, and more than likely no other team will claim him because they all have three foreign players they're happy with, and they're limited to three. And he will be sent on the first jet plane back to the United States. Something that I missed in our episode on the KBO is that there was an incident when Taylor Motter came over from the United States to South Korea. He was in a 14-day quarantine, and his wife, who was also there, tweeted something. I don't know what it is because it's been deleted and it has not been kept anywhere, disparaging about the food.
Oh.
And called on the U.S. Embassy in Seoul to help them out. And then Taylor Motter retweeted this tweet from his wife. So that caused a little bit of contention, perhaps justifiably. Although, I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe they just said they're serving us bad peanut butter and jelly. But I suspect not.
Seems unlikely. Seems bad. I just, you know, and I don't, none of this excuses. None of this is excused. But it seems like a difficult time in a marriage's life to be moving to a strange place. And it's definitely not cool to disrespect the food of a culture of which you are a visitor. But I also wonder how much her pregnancy contributed to her food sensitivity, which is a thing.
Yeah, but that would not excuse Taylor Motter's
retweeting
of it.
Yeah, it's bad. It's hairy.
He developed a reputation around the Heroes for complaining about everything. And again, maybe it's fair, maybe it's not. I don't know. Seems very difficult to be in his position. But either way, he blew it.
Yep.
So hopefully he can catch on somewhere else at some other point. Major League Baseball is coming back. Maybe he'll find a home on one of the expanded rosters.
Major League Baseball is coming back.
Or let me rephrase that. Major League Baseball is not coming back.
I thought that... Oh, no, sorry. That was the NBA. That was pretty sure it was going forward with July 31st. I continue not to think very much about the return of sports leagues. I don't want them to come back. I saw an email today that the Pirates were going to keep paying their minor leaguers, which is nice.
That's nice. Yeah, I mean, so there was a lot of hullabaloo about minor leaguers over the past 2 weeks since we last recorded. As of the day that we're recording, June 1st, major league teams are relieved from their agreement that they made at the beginning of the quarantine to pay minor leaguers $400 a week. And the Oakland A's said, that's it. We will not pay any of the minor leaguers moving forward. And people were rightfully upset about this. A lot of teams committed to continuing to pay their players, including the Pirates, which is nice. But most teams, except for the Royals and the another team, the Brewers, perhaps, I forget, committed to not releasing any minor league players during this time, which is nice of them. It's a little bit strange because, of course, if this were a normal season, many hundreds of players would have been released, but they would have had the opportunity to find landing places in other teams or in indie ball. And of course, there's nothing like that, let alone regular jobs. So a difficult time for that.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Also, there's a lot of contention between the players' union and the ownership, Major League Baseball. They would like to come back at the beginning of July, but to do that, they would have to start spring training like a week from now. And one way to put it would be that the owners and the players are far apart on an agreement. Another way to put it would be that the owners are refusing to budge an inch. And they're putting their own season and goodwill in jeopardy. I think it'll be a PR disaster if Major League Baseball, the sport that seems best positioned to come back, ends up being the one sport that doesn't.
I'm sorry I'm out of opinions.
There's been an incredible amount of, I have more opinions, of player solidarity. For one thing, a lot of players have been advocating for minor leaguers, which you barely ever see, for complicated and weird reasons. A second thing, a lot of players advocating on behalf of each other, a very strong sense of solidarity, such that even Buster Posey tweeted about it.
What?
Which I think says a lot.
Did he sign it, his tweet, with like a, you know, how like politicians will sometimes sign their tweets?
No, he linked to a Medium piece by some guy explaining why the owners are big goofwads and the players are right, which for Buster Posey was kind of like dropping the mic.
Right. Linking to someone else's article. Check out this citation. Buster Posey, Civil War buff?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Big nerd.
Yeah.
I miss normalcy.
Yeah, caring about things like what baseball players were interested in.
Yeah. Spending time thinking about my favorite baseball player, Buster Posey. He's not my favorite baseball player, but under normal circumstances, I'd probably be thinking about him a little bit more than I have been thinking about him, and that makes me sad.
Yeah?
Yeah. Want to talk about this book?
Yeah. Read a book over the past couple weeks called The Resisters by Gis Jen. Because the author was interviewed on Effectively Wild on the same episode as Emily Nemens.
It's good to have a stockpile of baseball books that we can turn to in this time. This is perhaps the least baseball book that we've read so far.
Yeah, I mean, the previous two books that we've read have been quite baseball.
Extremely baseball. Although, Universal Baseball Association, less baseball. I'm not surprised that this was inspired by Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
Very much in that vein, and I think is an archetype that I like to see more of. Meaning, it's like socially conscious, active athletes. Because I think that athletes are like, have like the largest share of being role models in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool to put those two ideas in the same conversation. I also thought that the character who was the Kaepernick figure, I guess, Gwen, was very strongly rendered. Good Kaepernick figure. Very, very, very inspiring. Very strong will.
Yeah.
I'm trying to wade into this book because, frankly, there were one or two things that I didn't love about it.
I put this as one bullet point, but it feels, I mean, one of the most striking things about the experience of reading this book to me was that in the middle of reading the book, George Floyd's killing happened and this national movement started. And this is a book that deals very explicitly, you might even say clumsily, with issues of race and class in the police state. And reading it initially, I thought, well, this fits very neatly into a long history of heavy-handed sci-fi. And then, I mean, as I ended the book, it didn't feel that way to me anymore. And this is my personal opinion. I don't know if you agree, but personally, at the end of the book, it felt very emotionally resonant, and the things that felt a little heavy-handed about it felt very true to life.
Yeah, there were things about it that definitely, over the past few days, began to sort of, I guess resonate is fine. That's the term.
Mm-hmm.
More than they had there, and yet there. Here's my first criticism of this book. It won't be my last, but it's the one that really rubbed me the most. That I kind of bumped up against was the amount of like unearned world building. There are just like a lot of terms for things in this universe that mm-hmm. are like that you know, the vibe is very Clockwork Orange in that sense, like in the way that the language is used. And the thing that I always have to remind myself, the big lesson that I took from Clockwork Orange, that I take with me to all books like this, is that is, you know, the, I suppose, the dialect that the book is written in. And if I give it a chapter, I will feel like at home in it and comfortable with it. And like, it will feel like a seamless part of this world that's been built. It did not feel that way at any point in this book. I mean, there's a lot in this book about just like standing up for your principles and not being moved by intimidation or anything that totally has resonated within the movement that's been built over the past few days here in this country. But in the context that we are currently living in, I also was frustrated by how frivolous some of the terminology was. They refer to some like deportation program as just like send them back.
Yes.
Or something like that, and that's kind of the tone that a lot of the terminology regarding the world is using, I feel. That's the sort of the most glaring example that stands out, to where I'm like, I don't know, it's a world, but I wish that I were better oriented to it so that it felt lived in, as opposed to just like, and as you know what else bothered me? I'm sorry, now I have opinions. Not a lot of effort in naming characters beyond the main characters was frustrating.
What's your issue? They all have like interesting names.
All their names are like, there's one guy whose name is War and Peace.
Yes, I do love that there's a character named War and Peace.
There's one character whose name is Ichiro Mariner.
True. All of the baseball players have funny names.
There's one character whose name is Rube Foster, and I think that's an actual baseball player. There were some that I was like, all right, baseball players have weird names, I get it. And then there were other ones where I was like, you just needed a name. Like, Names are important.
Yeah, and that's why someone has to be called War and Peace, to emphasize that they're important.
Someone needs to be called Joe March, the character from Little Women, but not... No relation, Joe March. They got universal basic income in this book. That's sort of the type of dystopia that we're talking about is one in which much of the world's, or at least the country's economy, I think the world too, but at very least our country's economy has been automated.
Yes.
And the people who's... Sorry, go on.
No, it's a thoroughly modern feeling kind of dystopia, in that what you're saying is true. It is an explicitly divided society between... I'm forgetting what they're called already. The netted and the...
The surplus.
Thank you. It's been like one day since I finished the book. It's already out of my mind, which is those who, per the governing AI, contribute something to society, and those who either don't, whose jobs have been totally replaced, or those who it deems unretrainable. And by chance, those who have been deemed unretrainable are all people of color.
Right.
Which is part of the reason this feels... so resonant and pertinent right now. It is not that they are doomed to poverty. Rather, there has been a universal basic income established, and the AI-driven society has become so efficient that it is the role of the surplus to consume as much as they can to get in good with the AI.
That gives me goosebumps. I haven't read it back like that. I don't know. I have a lot of feelings about the way that the world in this was deployed, and the sort of like point of view of the narrator, which the entire book is told through the perspective of the father of this pitcher, Gwen Cannon Chastanet. Should have written this down. Gwen's father, Grant, is the narrator through all of this. And my biggest frustration, my largest overall frustration with this book was that it seemed that everything was taking place at a distance.
Yeah, it's almost a second person narrative because the, you know, the ostensible main character of the book is Gwen.
Yeah.
It's not from her perspective. It takes place either via conversations with her or recounting of her experiences, or in the middle section, letters and transcriptions of her life.
It's an odd perspective, and I think that's what threw me the most, because I think what she was going for was to communicate something about a parent who, like, you know, I don't think it was an accidental thing that she chose to write this from the perspective of the parent who is like watching their child grow into this, like, you know, powerful being.
The author Gishen wrote this book right after her own child went to college.
Oh yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, but I think it's also a commentary on the surveillance mechanisms at play by the state in this, and the surveillance mechanisms used by Grant.
Oh, what is that? Wait, what do you mean by that? Say more. That's interesting.
In the entire middle section of the book, Gwen is at this netted university. She's recruited due to her prodigious baseball skill. And Grant, who's something of a tinkerer, bugs her up with a bunch of tiny surveillance equipment and listens to a lot of her conversations in a spooky, sneaky way.
Mm-hmm.
Grant, of course, and the entire Cannon family being a major leader of the resistance movement among I keep forgetting what they're called.
The surplus.
It draws a parallel between the ubiquitous and constantly surveilling Aunt Nettie, which is the name of the AI, and the so-called good resistors in Grant.
That's very interesting. I hadn't considered that. Sorry, I think in a lot of ways this book is hitting very close to home right now, and I've run out of things to say about home, so I don't have a ton to say about this book. Here's what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Unless you have something
Well, I mean, I have more things, but I'm curious what you're going to say.
I think that did I already talk a little bit about how this isn't a very baseball book?
No, you touched on it lightly, but I'm curious to hear more about that.
The baseballness of it is not portrayed in any great detail as it is, you know, as the action of it is in Universal Baseball Association, as the, like, world of baseball is portrayed in the, like, you know, like a very realistic world of baseball. Mm-hmm. It's like almost entirely pure symbol, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
As it becomes for resistance, I guess, or like Americanness, it's kind of tied up in a lot of things in strange ways. And again, it's another frustrating thing about this book that we don't really get a great sense of what baseball means to the larger country, such as it is. But we get a sense of what it means to resistance, whether or not it is, you know, it's something they do undercover. So it has that sort of just like rebellious flavor to it on its own. Whether that's a statement on what baseball means to America is, I don't know, up for debate or whatever. This is a book about America and it has to have baseball in it, I guess. What I thought was very striking vis-a-vis the baseball was Gish Jen's rendering of the role of the pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And also the pitcher-catcher relationship. I think that the character of Gwen is... I honestly, like, for as frustrated as I was with the narrator and the way that the story was kind of deployed, the character of Gwen I found to be very inspiring, frankly, very clear-headed, and, like, I understood her principles in a way that I think is very difficult to convey in a fictional character. And I found myself, like, really admiring this character for what she stood for. As far as her conflict is that she's this great pitcher, but her talent is very so she's a great pitcher, has a passion for the game, and her talent is very consistently used against her by pretty much just the state. I mean, the people who want to silence her mother, who is like another resistance leader, who's an activist and lawyer, and is like trying to uncover all of the evil crimes that the AI government is doing, and they dangle a baseball scholarship in front of Gwen if she'll only like cross over to the netted and like shut her family up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They keep trying to get her to try out for the Olympic team. Eventually, spoiler alert, they do kind of semi-kidnap her mother and hold her hostage to get her to the baseball team, to the Olympic baseball team, to get her to participate, that is. And I think the most striking thing about her character first, and then I'll say some more stuff about like what I think it means to like actual baseball literature,
mm-hmm.
is how, despite her passion, which is apparent, she is also apparently very willing to give it all up if it means leaving her friends and family behind.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some discussion in the middle section of the book between Gwen and her coach, her college coach, whose name is like Woody Link.
Yes, that's correct.
Something kind of silly like that. And Woody talks a lot about like what it takes to be a good pitcher, and I found it like a very astute observation about what it takes to be a good pitcher, but also just like very clear reflection of Gwen's character when they talk about being a rock on the mound and sort of letting pressure and the sort of external stimuli, distractions, letting those be waves that crash over you but that don't move you. Is a very pitcherly concept, I feel like. I got this quote here, more from the Rock of the Ocean. this is his little whatever, like, speech about rocks in the ocean. Don't ask yourself, is this me? Think of yourself as a rock in the ocean. No matter what crashes over you, you remain a mass to contend with, and that's your job. That's your job, to maintain your mass, your specific gravity, your strength, and to use your body language to get that across, because what your body says is how the whole team plays. You set the attitude for everyone. It's just, like, a very insightful expression of how baseball works, I think, on, like, a basic level. Just, like, the pitcher dictates the pace of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the play does not move forward without the pitcher. But B, I think it has the talk about, like, attitude and body language is more in depth than I've ever really been privy to. Like, this is the most in-depth discussion of pitcher mindset that I've ever been privy to. And I found it really compelling to think about, like, the fact that you have to have an attitude the whole time that you're on the mound. Like, it cannot just be to be a good pitcher. Like, you have to, like, the first step in being a good pitcher per this book, and it makes sense to me, like, it rings true, is to put the batter off balance with your attitude. Likewise, express to your team who is supporting you that you are in control. Control is also something that comes up a lot, both in terms of AI governments and pitching control. But I think that I just think that Gwen's character is so well written and so expressive. Like, it captures, I think, what it is to be a good pitcher and a good person. And I found that very compelling in ways that books that I've read about baseball before have not been able to do. And I think that's really cool. Period.
One thing that you mentioned was about the way that baseball is written about in this book. And I think it's interesting that the style of baseball is pretty old fashioned in this book. It takes place in the future. And baseball has been, like, kind of forgotten, not totally forgotten, but it's probably on the level of, like, I don't know, squash or something, until they reestablish it in the Olympics. And Aunt Nettie decides that it is of geopolitical importance to beat their arch rival, the Chine Russians,
This is what I'm talking about. Like, it's really serious out there right now, and it's like, oh yeah, it's they joined forces and they're called China Russia.
Yeah, of course. The country in this book, to be clear, is called the United States of Auto America because it's automated. There's a little bit of talk about analytics in the book, a little bit of talk about efficiency. But for the most part, I don't know how much Gishjian knows about sabermetrics or analytics. But regardless, the style of play is very old-fashioned. You know, Gwen will start on back-to-back days. There's bunting. One of the most striking things to me, not for any metaphorical reason, but just because it's funny, is that there is a human strike zone in the book, which is something that's discussed. They said they fought for the human called strike zone, which is interesting in such an automated world.
There's human umpires, so they are teaching Andy to, like, pitch frame.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of talk about her, like, the importance of her role, her being also a surplus and having been brought onto the team as a condition of Gwen's being brought onto the team.
Yes.
She seems to be a real boon, but she also seems really caught up in wanting to advance to the point where she, like, uses her catching powers I don't remember. I'm sorry, I went off on this thing. I liked it that they got real umpires, because I also feel that they need real umpires, because I think the human element of the game is interesting. Sorry, I'm kind of petering out here.
No, that's all right.
I gotta stop talking so much.
I don't really know where you were going with that.
Sorry. Can I get back on track somehow? Oh, boy.
Would you like to?
No.
Okay.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about DARPA.
Okay, let's do.
DARPA is the real-life organization of the United States government under the auspices of the Defense Department that develops crazy, cool, deadly, horrible sci-fi technology in real life, and also makes a very brief cameo appearance in this book.
Mm-hmm.
But as I sometimes do, I got interested in DARPA.
Great. As you sometimes do.
And found some of their current and former projects that felt very pertinent to this novel.
Okay.
One of the most striking is a project called CTS, or Combat Zones That See, which is a current project of DARPA, whose goal is to, quote, track everything that moves in a city by linking up a massive network of surveillance cameras to a centralized computer system, and artificial intelligence will then identify and track movement throughout the city.
Stinks.
Which is buck wild and absolutely a pitch-perfect description of what happens in this book. That is a genuine program DARPA is running for combat zones. They want to hook up all the surveillance cameras in any city so that they can track and identify enemy combatants, which is just a kind of a horrifying proposition. They can feed this every camera in a city. I mean, that's an unfathomable number of cameras, but have a computer actually be able to determine the whereabouts of everybody at once. So I thought that was kind of fun.
When did you think it was fun?
Before things in my life ceased to be fun a couple days ago.
Yeah.
DARPA, of course, was also the creator of the ARPANET, which was an early predecessor to the internet. And of course, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this dystopia is that it is an internet-based dystopia in which the internet becomes the ruling class. The internet kind of combines with an autocratic AI to take over the world.
Yeah.
You know, and in general, the internet has not been dominated by the military, but initially the ARPANET was a military application, and it's sad to consider the implications of it moving forward.
Before times, I thought this book was kind of a fun criticism on like the Internet of Things, that kind of development that's come out of 21st century like consumer tech, where like your refrigerator can check the weather or whatever the heck.
Yes, I'm familiar with that refrigerator.
Yeah, and then everything changed, and now I'm truly very afraid of the surveillance state, and I also would like to resist it, like in the book.
The Resistors.
The Resistors, that's the book title.
There are, of course, a lot of kinds of drones in this book. and of course DARPA works on drones. They have so many different warfare robots that they've worked on. Of course, drones, but they also have, like, cop robots in this book. Kind of like cops. And DARPA's worked on that. And they've also developed, and this is crazy, smart rifles. They've worked on a bullet or a sniper rifle system called X-Acto that fires a bullet that is capable of correcting its course and hitting a target even if you misfire. They also have smart guns in the book. So it seems like Gisjen may have also visited the DARPA Wikipedia page before delving into this novel.
A lot of fun. Fun, light beach read, the Wikipedia page that outlines how our government is trying to destroy the world. Sorry, you can cut that out.
No, I refuse to.
That's fine. This book, I think... at long last, my feeling on this book, maybe both before and now, is that it tackles a lot and perhaps too much.
There's a section of this book that's about sexual assault and the coach covering it up, which I think is a worthy thing to write about, but I feel like it kind of gets lost among the other themes of this book.
Yeah.
And it felt a little bit disrespectful to that topic to me, that it was kind of slotted in.
I thought that what was written about it was written very well.
Yeah.
I just thought it was, it kind of just felt like another thing that the author wanted to have a sort of criticism of book.
I think that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that it was handled poorly, just that on top of the other themes of the book, it felt like the last one. There wasn't anything wrong with the plot, just that it didn't feel central to me and consequently felt a little bit superfluous, which isn't something that you really want when you're discussing that topic.
That's fair. I think that's a perfectly fair and apt criticism. It was one of many things that happened. There's also a lot about knitting in here.
And you thought knitting was done a disservice. There is a lot about knitting in this book, huh?
There was an awful
lot
of
fabric talk.
Knitting. I was very skeptical that maybe I'm just not a very good knitter. Maybe this is possible, but
you can knit a baseball mitt.
Can you knit a baseball mitt is question one.
Okay.
Can you knit a baseball jacket? If what I'm imagining to be a baseball jacket is what I think it is. And it's like a classic sort of Letterman style with the leather sleeves and the felt interior, whatever.
No.
Quilted and what have you. Is that not what a baseball jacket?
That's a great point. You can't, I mean, anything that's knit is knit out of yarn. Or at least
obviously.
In this book it is. So I don't think that they were knitting leather.
I did not have an image in my head of what a baseball jacket was. Most strikingly.
Yes.
Can you knit your name?
Yes, of course.
I mean, if you use different colored fabrics, of course you can. But my sense of that section of the book where Eleanor is in jail and has been... I don't know what I would call what happens to her in prison. I mean,
she has her brain connected to the internet.
Yeah. That's. And so the idea being that they're gonna like use her as a puppet and make her say whatever the internet wants her to say.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of
like,
a good analogy for us.
What us like right now on this podcast?
Maybe I won't speak for you. That feels like a good analogy for me as a person.
Because
I'm just
you're
a tool of the internet, and I only say what it wants me to say.
I don't think it's the same thing.
No, but it was striking when you phrased it that way.
Okay.
Luckily, they haven't literally implanted a fibroblast mesh into my brain that causes me to be able to access the thoughts of everyone else who's also hooked up to the internet. That would be... bad.
Yeah, also the internet isn't sentient and doesn't have thoughts of its own. And also you can select whose thoughts you want to hear on the internet at all times. You always have a choice.
The houses in this book talk, and more specifically one house in this book talks, and it says you always have a choice.
I think that's something that only people who are not giving you a real choice say.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's pretty much explicit in the book.
It makes me wary of saying that when I do want to express to someone that they do have a choice
mm-hmm.
in the matter, but it's a very ominous phrase as it's deployed in this book. And I cannot imagine living in a house like that. It would drive me crazy.
It's almost like having a roommate.
If your roommate was
always offering to clean up after you.
Yeah, and telling you that you have agency, insisting that you have agency.
Actually, it sounds like a great roommate.
Yeah, I mean,
The point of the house is that it's convenient, but the main characters of this book don't enjoy having an auto house watch them all the time.
One thing that I will say for the world that was built is that it is built in such a way to where... you could understand people like there's an exploration of being an outsider to a place and sort of all the burden that comes with being an outsider to a place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Gish Jen did a good job of sort of exploring how, like, a perspective on oppressed people can exist that makes it seem like the oppressed people actually have it better. Or something. I feel like it's an affirmative action thing where, like, white people are bitter that affirmative action exists, even though the reason that affirmative action exists is that if it did not exist, there would be extreme racial disparity in universities. And I think that there's a lot in this book about how, to the netted, it seems that the surplus have it really sweet because they don't have to produce all the time.
Yeah.
And, like, they get these smart houses or whatever. So I assume that the netted also have smart houses. That's also not something that's really explored.
It's explored a little bit. They have similar kinds of AI, but it's not as grading or upfront.
It actually does give them a choice. I believe they can turn it.
It gives them a better illusion of choice.
I believe they can turn it on and off is a big difference.
Or so they think.
That is a strong part of the book. Communicating across class stratification combats. It's interesting that there were characters that were like, oh, I didn't know about that. Because you would think that people would know about that kind of stuff. But in this world.
I think it was a really good and interesting reflection of the real world. And it contrasted with most stratified dystopias in the sense that people were not, you know, disallowed from seeing each other. If a netted person wants to visit the Flotsam Towns, which is... where I keep forgetting what they're called.
The surplus.
If they want to visit the Flotsam Towns where the surplus live, they're absolutely free to do so. And kind of vice versa, it seems. It's just not where they live. But like in real life, people don't know that much about communities outside themselves.
Yeah.
And they were free to ask questions and learn about each other, and the state was not telling them what they can and can't do, but... by presenting them with this illusion of choice, it was able to uphold this incredible stratification without actual force.
Well applied.
Just like capitalism. I thought that was pretty good.
It was very good. I think that you did a really good job of nailing down what I could not in my point.
Yeah, except I couldn't remember the word surplus.
That's better than not being able to remember any words.
What would be, this is off topic, but I have to ask, your Please. Least favorite word to forget? Like, what would be the worst one?
Literally any word that doesn't come to mind when I want it is like the most frustrating and annoying experience lately.
Mm-hmm.
Because because they used to come to me. It used to be like, what's the word? Oh yeah, that's the word. And that's not a skill that I have anymore. So the answer is all of them.
For me, it would probably be the.
When you forget the word the?
If I were to forget a word, that would be the one I would least want to forget. In my real life, I forget every word all the time, and I have never been able to conjure them.
Words are interesting, aren't they?
I think they're pretty interesting.
Sometimes if you look close enough, you can find a word in another word.
Do you mean to say that sometimes words are constructed out of smaller words,
like
a mailbox?
Occasionally, sometimes they'll be like, if you look at the word network, you know it's right in the middle of the word network?
Twerk.
No, just the number 2, T-W-O.
Right okay, there, the, I both of middle. Us were correct.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's true, yeah. I just think that, I don't know, network, those three letters in the middle of the word network are doing something entirely different than they would do if they were on their own.
And you think that that's interesting because a network can be between two things or people.
Now I do.
I think that's great. I appreciate that.
I appreciate you.
Thank you. I appreciate you too.
Thank you. You got anything else you want to say about the book?
I want to make my joke about judges.
Okay.
In the book, Eleanor is a lawyer an activist lawyer, and she wins a major case against the AI because instead of having to face up against an auto judge or a robot, she gets to present her case to a real person. And I found that to be the most horrifying element of the book, because this book presents a world in which presenting a case to a human judge is a good thing. That's my joke.
That's your joke. Judges are terrible. Confusing. Seemingly contradictory. There's the section of the book that takes up the problem of college campus sexual assault and the silencing of school officials on the matter. Concerns something called an auto counselor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is said to be biased against the woman filing the complaint.
Yes.
Right? And I believe that the bias in that case is derived from the fact that it was designed and built by humans.
That would be my expectation as well, yeah.
So interesting. Well, I guess...
And that's one of the central questions of the book that kind of hovers over the text, and it's never addressed, is, are there any humans behind Aunt Nettie, the AI in the book? Or is it literally just a robot that runs everything? And then, in either case, what are the human biases that went into creating the system, and how do they manifest in terms of a robot society?
That's why I kind of wonder why a human judge would be any better than an auto judge. If an auto counselor has all the same biases of like a regular social worker who, you know, is feeling the pressure of university structure or whatever, like why do they get a break? Because it's a human.
Because humans have, and this is another theme of the book, the ability to see things outside of efficiency and their ultimate goal. The problem with an AI is that it is programmed for one thing. And for that reason, maybe Auto America would have beaten the China Russians because they only play baseball according to the analytics. And it's the same with a human judge. An auto judge will only work according to what's going to advance the needs of society. And per an auto judge, which is part of Aunt Nettie, the needs of society include winnowing and getting rid of the surplus population. But a human judge might not see things that way.
Extremely sad. Also, we never found out what they were drugging the food with.
Winnowing agents.
Yeah, winnowing agents.
I don't know what that means. It means poison.
Probably. Sad book.
Yeah, pretty sad. But you gotta read literature to help you think about the times that you live in a slightly different way. And I think that this book was really effective in doing that.
Do you think that we're obligated to engage with material that makes us uncomfortable?
Man, what a good question. It's really tough for me to say that, you know, obligated to do anything, but I can speak on behalf of myself, and I would say that I feel an obligation to engage with material that makes me uncomfortable.
Do you ever feel that, I'm speaking from a very particular place now,
mm-hmm.
Which is that I have experienced now riots like this, probably not on this scale, but, you know, stuff like this has happened before. And I totally get the impulse, like, I understand why it's valuable to be informed about what's going on. I wonder if you think that there is a cap or a line at which you draw and say, I know enough about the situation. I will, you know, keep abreast of it. But, like, I don't know. I we've been watching CNN, like, the past two nights in a row, like, without exception. Last time we watched, like, Space Ghost and Eraserhead to try to watch something else, but went back to CNN. And it's, I totally get it. It's important to stay informed and everything, but the way that it's like fed to us is it's a lot. Sometimes I want to stop.
Personally, I definitely have limits, and this is a different for me. This feels like a different question. For example, for me, I have not watched the video of George Floyd's killing, and I won't. I just don't do that. I don't even usually read a lot of details about these kinds of cases, and it's the same with mass shootings, because I find it too upsetting and not especially, I hope, not especially productive for me, in that I already feel a lot of outrage about it, but I also think that exposing myself to the details or the footage of murder is something that I don't want to do. But to me, that feels different than reading fiction that makes you uncomfortable. And maybe...
Oh, it certainly is.
I don't... Yeah, I mean, this, like... Maybe it's not. I mean, watching a violent video, and I've done it in the past, can cause you to reframe issues in your head the same way that fiction can. So maybe it's really not very different. Like, I think about this a lot. Like, I have this policy of not watching videos like that, and every time I don't do it, I question myself. I don't know if it's the right decision.
I just, you know, like, I feel like I recognize very much that I'm in a privileged position to be able to unplug from this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a privilege that I, like, am ashamed of taking advantage of. I don't know. Maybe I should. I can't tell, really, is my thing. Because, like you say, like, I feel plenty of outrage about it. I'm there.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm, like, trying to shelter myself from it. I think I just, like, I don't know, need a break from it. There have been helicopters outside my house every night for the past 3 nights. Okay. Sorry. That was a tangent.
I think it's good. I think, you know, ultimately, despite a lot of things about the past few days having made me very sad, I think it is good that we're seeing this kind of collective uprising. When I was marching yesterday along Flatbush Avenue, which is one of the busiest streets in Brooklyn, we closed down that street with cars on it. But despite that, as we halted traffic to a standstill and watched a lot of regular people sitting in their cars, every single person, without exception, was honking and cheering and waving their fists.
Oh, I, like, today, like, you know, I've been feeling probably the most sort of, like, focused and sustained rage as I've ever felt about any of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I cannot imagine myself not feeling angry. But it felt very good to, like, go and be with those folks. It felt good to be a part of a whole. And it felt, like, nourishing. Or, like, I guess cathartic is what I'm reaching for, because it, like, it had been building up, and I'd just been like, this is a fact, this is what people need to be seeing. And then to just, like, go and share space with folks that, like, I knew agreed with me largely, like that everybody was there with common purpose, made it, like, worth it. And made it feel like it was paid off almost, and that, like, it was like a, in a way, it was like a burden was lifted from me, and, like, it was something that I could, like, deposit into the space with everyone, this collective rage, and then just kind of, like, take a rest from it almost. I don't know, like, every time I think about resting from this, I feel guilty about it.
Oh yeah, I've felt more, but I totally... white guilt in the past couple days than I have in the rest of my life. I didn't participate in any action on Saturday, and I felt intensely bad about it.
Just gotta keep shouting online about it.
You
don't think it's productive to shout online?
No, maybe it is. To your point about feeling like a collective, I think what I've found about these protests is that they've felt so much more productive than what I've participated in before because of what you're saying. Because there's a very common purpose. You know, it's not like going to a women's march and a lot of people are holding up a sign that say that Donald Trump said a naughty word and I don't like the cut of his jib.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of, at marches and rallies that I've been to in the past, a lot of different opinions, not a lot of focus. And this feels like a very real movement and a very real sense of collective anger, but, you know, implicit, inherent in collective anger is that collectivity.
Hell yeah. Let's go get them. I don't know. We're going to wrap up tonight with a little snake fact for you. Philadelphia is home to the northern brown snake, which likes to hide under rocks, logs, or other items that get warm and cozy in the sun. Aw. It will bite, but is non-venomous. It will also puff up with air if it feels threatened. I think until the last sentence was just like a regular snake, like a regular snake thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm imagining like a puffed up snake.
Yeah. Do you remember in Shrek when Princess Fiona blows a snake up and makes it a balloon animal?
Yes, that's precisely what I'm imagining.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Or like a big Cheeto. All right. That's going to do it for us this week on Tater Tots. That's the name of the podcast. Hey. You can donate your money to Baseball for All. That's an important initiative that gets girls involved in youth baseball programs around the country, which is apt for this week's episode, especially so. In keeping with that aptness, if you want to throw some money towards a bail fund or something like that, that would be cool too. Minnesota Freedom Fund is one. Philadelphia Bail Fund is a big one for me. I don't know. I'm sure there's
I think the New York ones are all like maxed out. The one that really? I donated to said please stop donating to us, so I don't have any recommendations, but do look into it and throw some funds toward a bail fund.
Give your money to where it's needed. Give your Twitter interaction to us. We are on Twitter at Tater Tots Pod. You can like us on Facebook behind the Facebook URL / Tater Tots Pod. You can email us, tatertotspod@gmail.com. And you can join us every Thursday night on twitch.tv/tatertotspod. We'll be streaming our own dystopian sort of resistance kind of vibey road to the show with my friend and yours, Long John McCavity. And next week we'll be reading the young adult novel by the acclaimed author Michael Chabon. Ooh, gonna have to learn how to pronounce his name for next week. I think it's Chabon.
That could well be right.
This novel is called Summerland. It is a very interesting read. I think you'll enjoy it, Dunk. I can only hope that the same is true of our listener. Did your dad like the book?
I think so.
Oh, good. Okay. Maybe he'll like listening to us talk about it. All right, that's going to do it for us. Until then, stay safe. Goodbye.
Bye. Littlest league possible.